From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Peruvian novelist Mario Vargas Llosa, one of the leading figures in the recent boom in Latin American fiction. Also, I speak with jazz singer Chris Connor. She first became known as the singer who followed Anita O'Day and June Christie in the Stan Kenton Band. We'll hear some of her new album. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the second album from singer Daryl Sherman, and television critic David Bianculli explains how the writer's strike revived, at least temporarily, the weekly variety show. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Mario Vargas Llosa is one of the writers associated with the boom, that is, the boom in Latin American fiction that began in the 1960s. Vargas Llosa is Peruvian, and his novels draw on his knowledge of the politics, culture, and history of his country. Writer and critic John Updike called Vargas Llosa's writing a model of the most that political fiction can be. Robert Stone praised Vargas Llosa for his confident and intellectually exciting handling of the big questions. Vargas Llosa's career got started with a bang. His first novel, The Time of the Hero, was set in a military academy. After its publication in 1963, the Peruvian military burned 1,000 copies of it. Vargas Llosa was in Europe at the time, where he lived from 1958 until 1974, when he returned to Peru. His novels include Conversations in the Cathedral, Aunt Julia and the Scriptwriter, and The Year of the End of the World. I asked him first about his latest novel, Who Killed Palomino Molero, which has just been published in paperback. It's a murder mystery, and I wanted to know if he meant it as an homage to detective fiction.
Well, not exactly, because I'm not a great amateur of detective novels, you know. What I tried to do in this novel was to use the form of a thriller to tell a story which I think is not a detective novel, but something different. My intention in Who Killed Palomino Molero was not to tell a story about the investigation of a crime, but to use the investigation of a crime as a means to describe the mechanisms of power, or better, the mechanism of corruption of power in a country like Peru in the early 50s.
So your novels aren't so much concerned with who committed the violence, but why do people commit violence?
Exactly, or even better, why the violences that are committed are very difficult to be punished.
What kind of violence have you been exposed to politically or socially that has led to this interest?
Well, I think the kind of violence that appears in the novel is the kind of violence that you find more or less in all Latin American countries, a violence that derives from economic underdevelopment, from political corruption, from dictatorships, and also from social and economic inequalities in society. On the other hand, I tried in this novel to use the detective form, the detective devices, not only as a pretext, but also as something that could interest and thrill the curiosity of the reader. And in this sense, it was a new experience for me as a writer, because it was the first time that I used this technique in one of my novels.
You're one of the writers associated with what's been called the boom of the 1960s, the boom in Latin American fiction and its concurrent popularity in America. Do you it's ironic in a way that you were living in Europe at the time in the 1960s when your novel started to catch on.
Yes, I was, but and this was not only my case. You know, I think many Latin American writers, as myself, became Latin Americans when they were living abroad. I think they discovered, as it was my case, that Latin America was something more important than national cultures or national identities, and that we shared a lot from a cultural, historical, and a social point of view among the Latin American countries. And I think this process, which I personally had living in Europe in the 60s, was also the case of other Latin American writers.
What was it about living in Paris in the 1960s that brought out your identification with Latin America?
Well, first, I discovered that I was not an European and that I would never be an European.
I mean, you felt you had trouble fitting in with this culture that you had identified with.
Well, look, when I went to Europe in 1958, what I read mostly was European writers or North American writers, and I was really not much informed nor interested in what Latin America produced. And it was only living in Europe, meeting there writers and people from Venezuela, from Argentina, from Mexico. Paris at that time was really central point of Latin American people, that I little by little became interested in Latin America and start to think of myself more as a Latin American than as a Peruvian. And I think this is something that happened also to writers like the Argentine Julio Cortázar, who was living in Paris since the beginning of the 50s, and probably many, many other writers started to feel as Latin Americans more than Venezuelans, Argentines, or Mexicans when they went abroad and perceived Latin America as a whole, something that it was not so common in the 50s when you were living in a Latin American country.
So part of many of the novels you've written about your country have been written from abroad. Did you try to keep coming back to Peru so that you'd understand how the country was changing over the years and so you'd be able to still be current in your perceptions?
Well, I lived in Europe since 58 until 74, but during those years I returned many times to Peru for short periods of time, 1 month and, well, even 2 months once. But only in 74 I returned to live in Peru. And I decided to come back to my country because, yes, I had the feeling that I was losing touch, losing contact with what was going on, with all the changes in Peru, and even with the language, with the Spanish Peruvian language. And that I felt as a threat for my writing, for my vocation. So I decided to return, and since 1974 I've been living in Peru.
So you mean you needed to speak the language in order to keep writing in it?
Well, to speak, to hear the language. I think it's very important to hear the language, is the living language. I think that is very important for a writer, or at least for the kind of writer that I am, a writer that is always working with the living experience of his world, of his society. For that, I think it was very important to keep in touch with what was going on in my country.
Mario Vargas Llosa is my guest, and his new novel is titled Who Killed Palomino Molyero? You've become politically outspoken in Peru, and one of the things you've been speaking out against is President Alan Garcia's plan to nationalize banking. Why are you taking such an active stand on that?
Well, because I want to preserve democracy in Peru. I think it's very important to keep this democratic system that we have in Peru since 1980, when the military dictatorship was obliged to call elections. Many Peruvians felt that it was a threat to democracy, this nationalization of the whole financial system, which would have given to the government and a tremendous power to manipulate the media and to manipulate elections. If we want to keep a democratic system, we don't want a one-party democracy, and that's what would have been happening in Peru if the government of Alan Garcia would have controlled the whole economy of the country through the credits.
You've described yourself in the past as a political moderate, and I think some of the other best-known Latin American writers, like Marquez and Fuentes, are probably more politically to the left than you are. Has that created some distance between you and them?
Well, not personal. Political distance, yes, because I don't think extremism can solve the problems of Latin America. My impression is that most of the problems that we have derive from the extremist policies, and I think moderation is the best way to stop the violence that is being so damaging and in some cases threats to destroy our societies. But if you believe in democracy, you accept discrepancies, that you must be tolerant with people who think differently of you.
You've said that you think that many Latin American intellectuals are too dogmatic.
Well, because in Latin America, you know, something curious arrives, something curious happens, and that is that extremist ideologies, dogmaticism, and even fanatical attitudes are more common in the university and intellectual circles than in the workers or peasants sections of the population.
The middle class, in other words.
Yes, that means that the victims, the worst victims of our societies, of our social and economic inequalities, are for moderation. And in fact, people who in a way can be considered privileged or beneficiaries of the system are sometimes in favor of radicalism and even the most extremist policies. And it's a very curious contradiction.
My guest is writer Mario Vargas Llosa, and his latest novel is titled Who Killed Palomino Mollero? I want to go back to 1963 and to your first, the first novel that really got you recognition, The Time of the Hero. And this was a satire of life in a Peruvian military academy. Now, this was based in part on your experiences in a military academy, yes?
Yes, that's right. I was for 2 years in the military school, which is the settlement of the Time of the Hero.
Did you want to go?
No, I didn't. It was really my father who suggested the military school, and at that time I had the thought for once to go to the Navy school when I finished my school, and that was the reason why I accepted the suggestion of my father. It was a very difficult experience. I had, in fact, a shock when I was submitted to this discipline, military discipline in the school, a discipline which was, in many cases, brutal, really barbaric, and that gave me the idea of the novel. Yes, that was my first novel, and I wrote it between 1958 and 1961.
Now, you had wanted to be a writer even when you were younger, and I think that your father considered that a little effeminate. Did he want to send you to the military academy to toughen you up a little bit? Was that the idea?
Well, my father, as many middle-class people in Latin America in the 50s, you know, thought that to be a writer was to be an eccentric, someone marginal to the extreme life of society, literature or art in general. At that time in Latin America was really an eccentric activity. And so he was worried when he discovered that I wrote poems or short stories. And he thought that maybe a military school could be an antidote for this literary vocation.
Kind of backfired, didn't it?
In fact, it backfired, and it was the opposite, yes.
So you were exposed to very harsh discipline. Are there incidents that you really remember still with a lot of anger or horror when you look back?
Well, no, because all the bad experiences I have turned into literature, you know, and so I've been cured of those bad experiences through my books.
Now, the military burned, I think, 1,000 copies of that novel about the military academy. Was it the people who were at the school that you wrote about?
Well, the copies were burned at the school as protests against what they thought it was an insult against the school and against the tradition of the school. But I wasn't in Peru at that time, you know. I was living in Europe, so I only read in the papers about this event. I was really surprised because I had thought that my book would be, well, published and that there would be some readers from the book in Peru, but I never expected such an scandal. And all this, of course, was great publicity for the book, so the book became a kind of bestseller in Peru, but I never knew if it was because its literary qualities or because the military had burned 1,000 copies of it.
Did you get a kick out of reading articles about the burning of your book while you were living in Europe?
Well, I was so amazed, you know, when I received these clippings of the papers with this inquisitorial action, you know. I couldn't believe my eyes. I was really, really amazed, you know.
Did you want to know the details, like where was it burned? Did they use gasoline to set it on fire? You know, that kind of stuff.
No, well, what I knew was that the burn had taken place at the school and in an official ceremony, but there was a big scandal. There were many generals, for instance, who went to the papers, to the media, to denounce the book as something offensive for the army, and there was even that was probably the most unexpected and comic reaction to the book. A general who was at that time, I think, the chairman of a center for military studies, wrote an article in a newspaper saying that probably this book had been paid by the Ecuadorian army in order to demoralize the Peruvian soldiers and officers. And that was probably the most comic reaction that this book produced in Peru.
Well, young writers need confidence. This must have given you a shot of confidence to have such a strong reaction.
Well, yes, in fact, it gave me a lot of enthusiasm because I discovered that my novel had reached an audience and also had provoked this kind of passional reactions that literature, I think, should provoke.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your writing and your life, but first we're going to take a short break. Writer Mario Vargas Llosa is my guest, and his latest novel is titled Who Killed Palomino Molyero? This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Peruvian writer Mario Vargas Llosa is my guest. Well, you were telling us that your father had really been afraid that writing was a much too marginal kind of profession, and from what I've read, he thought it was a little effeminate, too. Did that kind of fear of writing and the arts stay with you at all? Did you get totally purged of thinking, well, what your father thought about it or what other adults or people in the mainstream might have thought about it?
Well, there were many prejudices in Peru, and I presume in other Latin American countries, against writers and artists in the 50s. I think that this has changed a lot in Latin America, particularly since this phenomenon called the boom of the Latin American narrative. Since then, on the contrary, I would say that literature has become fashionable in Latin America, and that there are, on the contrary, now a favorable prejudice for writers. In this, we have experienced really great changes in Latin America. When I started as a writer, you know, a Latin American writer had tremendous difficulties to be published, and most writers publish their books themselves, and they knew that only very few copies would be sold, and that the possibility of their books to reach really a large audience was very, very rare, very exceptional. This has changed since the 60s a lot. Now there are, many publishing houses. It's difficult that a good novel wouldn't be published. On the contrary, there are publishers trying to find books, and we have books that sell in Latin America sometimes by hundreds of thousands of copies, something that was unthinkable 30 years ago.
I want to ask you about another one of your novels, Aunt Julia and the Scriptwriter, which is also pretty autobiographical, and it's about a young writer who's working in the news department of a radio station trying to break into writing. And there's a Bolivian writer who writes the soap operas for this radio station in Peru, and the soap operas, everybody just like stops during the day to listen to them. Did you have experiences like that? Were you working at a news department at a radio station when you were starting out? And did you know a very successful but kind of crazy soap opera writer?
Well, soap operas were tremendously popular all over Latin America in the 50s when I worked in that radio station. And there was in a neighboring radio station a soap opera scriptwriter who was very popular in Peru. And he was, an inspiration for the character of the soap opera scriptwriter of Aunt Julia and the scriptwriter. But this is not a biography of that scriptwriter. I've used this just as a raw material, and there are much more invention than history in the book. And even in the autobiographical chapters in the book, in which the author appears himself as a character, there is a lot also of deformation and manipulation of the truth. No? So it's a novel, not it's a disguise autobiography.
Well, I think it's the character appearing as the novelist who says that at the time he was obsessed with the idea that fiction should be realistic. Did you go through a period like that yourself?
Well, I think I still have this realistic, orientation, perversion, I don't know. But I need to have the feeling that my books have a hold, are sustained in a realistic experience, even if I am perfectly conscious that literature is never a mere reflection of reality, a mere reproduction of reality. I think literature is a separate reality, something that you create and something that has a distance with reality. But for me, the way in which I imagine, I fantasize, I invent more easily is having the real world, the real life as a model for my writing.
Now, one other question about Aunt Julia and the scriptwriter. One of the many places I think that your life overlaps the life of the main character is that the main character marries his older divorced aunt and then marries a cousin, and that is also what happened in your life. Was that something of a scandal in your family?
Well, yes, it was. Yes, it was. I married when I was very young. I was 18 years old, and this, of course, for my family was a great surprise and a great great scandal at the beginning. Yes. But I've been surrounded by scandals all my life. You
know? Was it coincidence that you married two women who were parts of the family in some way?
Well, I don't know. Let's ask a psychoanalyst, you know.
Okay. You have an essay that you wrote several years ago called Is Fiction the Art of Lying? And now I think it was, maybe it wasn't in that essay, maybe it was in another essay, that you were writing about something that James Baldwin once wrote, and how it resonated with you. And Baldwin said that when he was at one of these big writers' conferences, he'd always want to be able to tell, is this audience racist or not? And the way he would do it would be to spout absurd theories and stupid remarks, and if these stupid remarks evoked a big ovation from the audience, he'd know that they were really racist.
Yes.
How does that apply to your experiences?
No, it wasn't in that article, but it was in another article. But yes, I always have in mind this anecdote that I heard James Baldwin to tell. Yes. Well, I think it's very, very instructive what he said about prejudices, I used this anecdote to write an article describing a literary meeting in Denmark in which Danish writers had invited a radical Latin American writer who, during the whole Congress, pronounced the most crazy and stupid demagogic speeches, you know. But all the Danish writers that were there felt obliged to listen very attentively, to show great sympathy and enthusiasm for all the stupid things that they were hearing. And I suppose the reason was exactly, as in the James Baldwin anecdote, because this writer came from Latin America, represented for them the voice of the exploited people, and so they felt that they were obliged to give respect and admiration to something that in the mouth of a Danish writer would have been absolutely unacceptable for them, you know.
So are there times that you've tried this out yourself to test if an audience is reacting in a biased way to your remarks?
No, I have never done that.
Now, you write in Spanish, yes?
Yes, I do.
Do you ever read the translations of your work?
Well, I try to help the translators if they want to, if they ask me to, well, to suggest or to give them some advice. Yes, of course, I do it. But in general, I don't like to go back to what I've written, you know?
So when you read the translations, do you like them usually?
No, usually not.
You're retranslating it in your own mind?
Yes.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you very
well,
much.
Well, thank you.
My guest has been Peruvian novelist Mario Vargas Llosa. His latest novel, Who Killed Palomino Molero, has just been published in paperback by Collier Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Argentinian tango composer and accordionist Astor Piazzolla. He's at the forefront of the tango revival, although his current work is also influenced by jazz, classical music, and opera. Here's music from one of his recent recordings.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I speak with jazz singer Chris Connor. Best known for her work with Stan Kenton's band, Connor is recording again and has just completed a new album. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the second album by singer Daryl Sherman. And television critic David Bianculli discusses how the writer's strike breathed new life into the variety show. He says the eclecticism of The Ed Sullivan Show is back in a new Smothers Brothers comedy hour. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. In the Persian Gulf today, U.S. and Iranian forces exchanged attacks. First, the U.S. fired on two Iranian oil platforms. Then, Iranian gunboats attacked a U.S. helicopter and a U.S. frigate. The U.S. responded, sinking an Iranian patrol boat and damaging two Iranian frigates. This afternoon, Defense Secretary Frank Carlucci announced that a U.S. helicopter was missing. Iran has said it shot down the helicopter, but there is no confirmation of that claim at this time. We have two reports, the first from Ann Garrels.
Speaking to a group of building contractors this afternoon, President Reagan said he had taken this action to make certain the Iranians have no illusions about the cost of irresponsible behavior. According to State Department spokesman Charles Redman, the United States has repeatedly warned Iran not to lay mines. The last of four warnings was delivered in October. After that, officials believed Iran had got the message and stopped. Today, the United States sent Iran another warning, threatening a firm U.S. response to any military or terrorist threat to Americans or American interests. President Reagan said the Iranians must know we will protect our ships, and if they threaten us, they will pay a price. Spokesman Charles Redman said the U.S. does not want an escalation in the war, but an end to it. And he called for renewed efforts to impose an arms embargo against Iran, because Iran has not agreed to a United Nations demand for an immediate ceasefire. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
This is Phyllis Crockett at the Capitol. Today, one word can sum up the mood in Congress: supportive. The senators and representatives talking today all said they thought the action taken was the right thing to do under the circumstances. There was some disagreement about whether or not the hostilities in the area triggered the War Powers Act. Senator Arlen Specter said it did. Other senators said it did not. Senator Sam Nunn is chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee.
Now, the War Powers Act does not prohibit the United States from retaliating when we have been engaged by hostile fire. That was never the intent of the act. The president has not violated the act by taking this action.
The War Powers Act requires the president to give notice to the Congress when hostilities have occurred or are imminent. Since the president did that, Congress, at least for now, seems satisfied. Phyllis Crockett, Capitol Hill.
There are unconfirmed reports out of Beirut today that U.S. Marine Lieutenant Colonel William Higgins has been killed by his kidnappers. The report on the Voice of Lebanon was immediately denied by the pro-Syrian Shiite Amal, which has blamed the kidnapping on the pro-Iranian Hezbollah. United Nations officials say they cannot confirm the story on the radio service, which is not considered reliable in reports concerning Western hostages. Higgins has been missing since February. Ibrahim Hussein of Kenya today became the first African to win the Boston Marathon. Hussein sprinted away from Juma Nkanga of Tanzania in the 92nd running of the race. Andrew Caffrey of member station WBUR reports.
Hussein and Nkanga ran shoulder to shoulder the entire race, but in the last 100 yards, Hussein outkicked his African rival to win by 1 second. It was the closest finish in the Boston Marathon's history. Hussein says his strategy was to sit behind the leader until the very end.
Well, my main aim was to let somebody else do the work and I will sit behind. And I think it worked the way I wanted to.
In the women's race, defending champ Rosa Mota of Portugal won her second straight Boston Marathon. Today's top showing by a Kenyan and a Tanzanian asserts African runners as the world's most dominant marathoners. Yesterday, an Ethiopian runner won the Rotterdam Marathon and in the process set a new world record, breaking the previous one by 23 seconds. For National Public Radio, I'm Andrew Caffrey in Boston.
And on Wall Street today, the Dow Jones average dropped 5 points to close at 2008.12. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new album by singer and pianist Daryl Sherman. Sherman released her first album 4 years ago and then worked with the revived Artie Shaw Band, singing songs associated with Billie Holiday and Helen Forrest. Sherman's new album, her second, was recorded at Freddie's Supper Club in Manhattan.
It's a pity to say goodnight, because I never saw stars so bright. But if you're gonna go home, you're gonna go home, give me a good night kiss. It's a pity to say farewell, because I'm early, the moon won't tell. But if you're gonna go home, you gotta go home, give me a good night kiss.
The more I listen to jazz singers like Billie Holiday and Abbie Lincoln, the more it seems they're great not in spite of, but because of the narrow range of pitch in which they sing. Jazz singers, the old saw goes, use their voices like a horn. But we're also told that the best jazz players make their instruments speak, a throwback to Africa's talking drums. Singers like Holiday and Lincoln rarely wander very far from the contours of speech. At her best, neither does Daryl Sherman, whose second album is She's a Great Great Girl on the Tono label. Sherman's style is a victory of taste over her considerable technique, even if taste doesn't win every round. Her takes on vintage pop tunes follow a familiar curve. She'll sing a melody more or less straight on the opening verse, gradually taking greater liberties as she goes on. On some tunes, she tends to go a bit overboard by the time she gets to the closing chorus. As a rule, I like her quieter early verses better than the brassy final ones. She's best not when she loses herself in a lyric, but when she maintains a little ironic distance, especially when she's singing some neglected gem like Moon Country, Hoagy Carmichael and Johnny Mercer's ode to good old days that never were.
I know where the peach trees bear a harvest all the year round. And I know where the old gray mare eats bluegrass from the ground. That's where folks never turn a hand. They just live off the land. My rocking chair is waiting there. That's why I'm homeward bound. I long for that moon country, that possum and coon country, that sycamore heaven back south. I'll lose my mind till I get there. I long for that old country, that good for the soul country, good for cooking things that melt in your mouth. When my cousin Cindy Lou plays a twilight hymn for you, she makes that old piano sound exactly like brand new. I long for that moon country. That's where I should be, for that old moon country is home for me.
Those dippy guitar licks are by Jay Berliner, who feeds on and fuels Sherman's own humorous streak. The backing crew on this cabaret set also includes bassist Jack Six, trombonist Dan Barrett, and trumpeter Dick Sudhalter. Sherman and Mike Renzi alternate at the piano. Another amusing trifle Sherman resurrects is an old Ames Brothers curio, the Naughty Lady of Shady Lane. This time, guitarist Berliner adds some nice, if incongruous, Latin licks.
The naughty lady of Shady Lane has hit the town like a bomb. The backstreet gossip ain't been this good since Mabel ran off with Tom. Our town was peaceful and quiet before she came on the scene. The lady has started a riot. disturbing the suburban routine. The naughty lady of Shady Lane has the child in a whirl. The naughty lady of Shady Lane. Me, oh my, oh, what a girl.
That song builds to a cute punchline. That disruptive lady with a drink habit turns out to be a 9-day-old infant. Like other cabaret singers, Sherman flirts with cuteness a little too often, and her penchant for odd material sometimes leads her astray. The Brazil 66 hit, Pretty World, is pretty icky, and she vainly tries to slay us with a limp noodle of a pop tune through the fire. But when she doesn't push it, when she sounds like she's talking to us instead of taking aim at us, Sherman reminds us that good jazz singing, while highly improbable, isn't impossible. When she's good, she's very good. Better than some other singers who get a lot more airplay and a lot more press.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Daryl Sherman's new album, She's a Great, Great Girl, on the Tono label.
How about tomorrow, not just you, baby? Underneath the apple tree, it really gives a pity, cause I'm sitting kind of pretty and I love you to hold me tight. But if you gotta go home, you gotta go home. You gotta go home, you gotta go home. You gotta go home, you gotta go home. Give me a good night kiss.
You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is veteran jazz singer Chris Connor. She first became known as the singer who succeeded Anita O'Day and June Christie in the Stan Kenton Band. The 1960s and 70s were lean years for her, but the 1980s brought more club dates and a series of albums on Contemporary Records. Her new album is called New Again, and from that record, here's Jerome Kern's Dearly Beloved.
Dearly beloved, how clearly I see. Somewhere in heaven, you were fashioned for me. Angel eyes knew you. Angel voices led me to you.
When she was 20, Chris Connor left her home in Kansas City for New York, determined to someday sing with the Stan Kenton Band. Her first steady job was as lead singer with the Snowflakes, that was the vocal group with the Claude Thornhill Orchestra. She stayed with Thornhill for 5 years. During her brief stint with Jerry Wald's band, Stan Kenton called her up.
June Christie happened to be listening to a radio that night, and she heard me, and she was leaving the Kenton Band, and so she recommended me.
I think the record that you're best known for with the Kenton Band is All About Ronnie. How did you get to sing and record that song?
Since I was just joining, he wanted a particular, you know, a special song for me that I would be known for. So he just had a songwriter by the name of Joe Green write it for me, especially. And I recorded with the band, and that's sort of been my, you know, signature song.
All About Ronnie. His whisper that
No, I think it's the woman singer was supposed to really like look good on stage, more so than the musicians. You know, she was more of like the showpiece.
That's true.
And you had to wear gowns and everything. Mm-hmm. It must have been really hard to look and feel fresh when you're sleeping on a bus half the time.
That's right. That's right. Well, a lot of times you didn't get any sleep either, and you'd stop and have a hamburger on the road. And I'll never forget those days. I used to check in a hotel after about a 300-mile tour, ride, and I'd get in and take one look at my gown. I'd put it in the shower, put it on as hot as I could, close the door, and then all the wrinkles would come out. And that's what I wore, And I used to look at all these, beautiful people, dancing in front of me, and they would look so marvelous, nice and fresh, and that's what really got me down.
It's funny because they were probably all looking at you and thinking like, oh, I wish I could be that singer. What a glamorous life.
Probably. I don't know. But it was anything but glamorous. It was great.
You stayed with Kenton's band only about 18 months. Why did you want to leave?
Well, I didn't really want to, but at the time, I had been with Claude Thornhill, as I said, for about 5 years, and all one-nighters, very grueling and being on the road. And so by the time I was with Stan for about a year, I just, health-wise, I needed a rest. I'd really had it. And so that's the only reason that I left. So I just took off, and at that time I got myself a new manager, and then I had my own trio for a long time, and I recorded with Bethlehem Records after that. And that was very, good for me, too.
I think a lot of the singers who made it commercially in the 50s and 60s turned to either pop or middle-of-the-road music. Were you tempted to do that?
No, I never was. I never wanted to compromise. I mean, I wanted to sing tunes that not everyone did. And I always wanted to do research and look for different things that hadn't been overdone and something that meant something to me emotionally, lyrically.
You do a song on your new record that I really love, My Foolish Heart. It's a standard. It's a song a lot of people have done, but you do it beautifully, and it's such a wonderful song. Why did you want to include that?
Well, that's another one that I've always wanted to do ever since I saw Susan Hayward in the picture. I always go back to the 40s for some reason. I think I'm with Rosemary Clooney as far as that's concerned. I went to see her at the Blue Note, and she said, I'm hooked on the 40s, and I guess I am too, as far as most of the songs are concerned.
The night is like a lovely tune. Beware my foolish heart. How white the ever constant moon. Take care, my foolish heart.
Jazz stopped being the popular music of the time in the 50s and 60s, and in a lot of ways it was replaced by rock in terms of commercial popularity.
Yes.
Did that make for hard times for you?
Yes, it did. Yes, especially in the 70s. That was a very, very bad, not only for me, but for other singers that, jazz singers or pop jazz, whatever you want to call me. Rock came in with the Beatles and it knocked a lot of people out of work, and you couldn't get, bookings were few and far between. So that was a very lean period. But I kept singing, I'd go to Japan or Europe or other places, so I wasn't idle.
You developed an alcohol problem too. Was that during that period?
No, I think that was a gradual thing from the 60s on or something like that. It was just that's something that sneaks up on you, and I don't know whether it was they don't know the cause of it. I think it's I just don't know, but I'm over that. That's past history.
Yeah, I know.
And has been for a long time. And but I know it's very easy to, it's very easy to have it happen to you. Not just if you're a singer, if you're anyone.
After you gave up alcohol, did it take a lot of courage to go back on stage again?
It took a lot of courage to walk into my first nightclub. That was the hardest part. because I thought, how, you know, how can I face my the rest of my life being a singer and being in nightclubs and having people, first thing they say to you, have a drink, Chris, can I buy you a drink, you know? And you have to keep saying no, 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 no. And the first night, it was very hard. But after that, it, you know, it gets easy. And now it's completely, you know, I don't even think about it. It just gets easier all the time to say no.
Can we talk about your voice? You have such a beautiful voice, and there's a certain dark shading to your voice that I really love. And I'd like to know if that's something that you feel you've worked for, consciously tried for, or is that just the way it is?
No, it's just really natural. But I think the more you sing, and the older, you know, the older and the more mature, I think it, like I know for myself, my voice has deepened and my range has lowered, and I think the more you sing, you know, the better you get. That's all it comes with, you know, singing all the time.
Well, I think that kind of deepening really suits you. How do you feel about how your voice has changed as you've gotten older?
I like it. I like it much better. In fact, I was listening to some records that I recorded with Maynard Ferguson yesterday, in fact, and I couldn't believe that was me because I had such a much higher range than I do now. But I like the sound of my voice now, you know, better.
Chris Conner, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much, Terry. I've enjoyed it.
Heaven, I'm in heaven, and my heart beats so that I can hardly speak, and I seem to find the happiness I seek when we're out together dancing cheek to cheek. Heaven, I'm in heaven, and the cares that hung around me through the week seem to vanish like a gambler's luck.
Chris Conner's new album, New Again, is on Contemporary Records. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
I presume you're following the exchange of gunfire and missiles in the Gulf between Iran and the United States.
Yes, we'll have the latest on what's happening there. Of course, earlier today, the U.S. had fired on two Iranian oil platforms in the Gulf. Iran struck back. The U.S. fired back on them. The latest is that President Reagan has issued a statement that after today's exchange of fire, we won't be firing anymore. Essentially, the U.S. says to Iran, we won't shoot if you don't shoot. It's up to you. Also tonight, we have an interview with Jesse Jackson. The New York primary is tomorrow, and we ask him about the issues.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Recent attempts at reviving the television variety show have not fared well, but television critic David Bianculli says the new Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour is providing a delightful and entertaining model for success.
The writer's strike is really beginning to affect television. Moonlighting has called it quits for the season. Saturday Night Live has been in repeats for months, and some new shows, like CBS's The Dictator, have been yanked from the schedule before their premieres and won't show up until the fall. There's one area, though, where the writer's strike may actually have helped things. It may have indirectly solved one of the toughest TV dilemmas of the 80s, how to breathe life into the weekly variety show. Here's what happened. The Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour started out in February as a one-shot special and got such good response that CBS ordered six more as a springtime weekly series. Then came the writer's strike, and the Smothers Brothers weekly show was yanked from the schedule, and then, a day or two later, was put right back. The Smothers Brothers had told CBS that they already had gathered enough written material to flesh out two shows and could basically fake a third with a concert-style program. The Smothers Brothers, remember, used to deliver their shows at the last minute back in the good old days, so the pressure was no big deal. CBS, with its schedule falling apart right and left, said okay, and the Smothers have mounted three shows without using any writers. This week's show, their fourth, is a repeat of the February special which started the ball rolling again, and there's no telling what, if anything, will come next. What's been done so far, though, is a variety show without skits, a show entirely dependent upon the talent and variety of its guests. In the last few weeks, Tom and Dick Smothers have presented Linda Ronstadt singing Mexican songs, Jim Stafford playing Spanish guitar, Jack Lemmon and Ned Beatty reciting poetry, a 10-year-old playing classical violin, Buster Poindexter rocking out, and a wide range of clowns, jugglers, and jokesters. What you are about to hear is the sound of the TV variety show being reborn.
Here singing the song of the rodeo, Linda Ronstadt.
Once upon a time, in the land of Hushabye, around the wondrous days of yore, they came across a sort of box, bound up with chains and locked with locks, and labeled, "Kindly do not touch. It's war."
Please meet Mr. Jim Stafford.
Tonight I'd like to play a song for you on the guitar and tell you a little bit about its history. It has a fascinating history. The guitar was invented in Spain. As a matter of fact, guitar is the Spanish word for guitar.
Because there were no writers, the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour filled its shows with the most eclectic group of guests this side of the Ed Sullivan Show. And that formula still works. When the writers come back, they ought to use these makeshift shows as blueprints, adding a skit or two, perhaps, but continuing to put the variety back in the variety show. And if the writers won't do that, who needs them?
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post.
We had the Yo-Yo Man on the show, and as you can plainly see, he's back this week. Aren't you, Yo-Yo Man? You got your spirit of yo with you? That's right. Let's hear it for the Yo-Yo Man and his spirit of yo. Don Smothers is the Yo-Yo Man. Now, to get in the groove, Yo-Yo Man. Get in the groove. Do some. There he's go. See, when you're in a state of yo, you're just so groovy, you don't even touch the ground. He does some loop-de-loops there. You remember the loop-de-loops when you tried them?
Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow I'll speak with pianist Ursula Oppens, one of the leading interpreters of new music. Many contemporary composers have written works for her. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will profile Alan Freed, one of the fathers of rock and roll radio. And guest book critic Leon Schreiber will review Night Over Day Over Night, the first novel by Paul Watkins. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistants from Ed Doherty, Chris Spurgeon, and Lisa Bruton, who directed today's show. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.